But compassion isn't always saying yes.
Uh-uh. Compassion's tough. Yeah. I mean, Guard, you mentioned that last time.
It's the toughest value there is if people truly understood it.
Yeah.
Because it requires you to keep yourself vulnerable, to keep your heart open, and people are afraid of doing that because they've been traumatized.
Of course.
It requires you to keep your mind open to new possibilities and new imaginative ways, but people are afraid to do it. So how do we open that up? So I would actually, Clay, I challenge you to give me that piece of legislation. I will give it to our congressional delegation. There's only one that won't listen, but I will tell you which party. but the others will listen. And they are the kind of people, we have the kind of relationship, they'll do something about this. And I think it's time. I think that seventh generation deserves a politic, a business culture, Wall Street, where every person is required to sign a basic code of trust.
Hello, world. It's me, Dennis, and we are in search of the new compassionate male. I'm getting a chance to produce this episode of the podcast, and I'm here with the founder, Clay Boykin. Hello, Clay. Boy, do we have a slate on today.
We sure do. We've got Guard Jamison, who's returning to us from August of this last year when we first talked, and Dana White, who, Dana, you've been on the show a couple of times, and it's wonderful for y'all to be back. So much has transpired since August, and this opportunity to get together and peel the onion back a little bit more on the whole topic of men and compassion, yes, consciousness about among men. And, you know, everything goes here. And but I wanted to ask, maybe kind of as a way of getting started, Guard, you mentioned an article that you had sent and published from Hiroshima to COVID. And I just remember the major transformation, and you were talking about that. I'm just wondering if we might use that as a launch point this morning.
Yeah, it's the times we're living in we're blessed, we're privileged to be alive at this moment, because this is a major shifting moment. And as a friend of mine, Rabbi Sodendorp, who's the chief rabbi of Holland, said, we are living now in the holy decade. And in this next 10 years, starting in 2021, which we're in now, there's going to need to be more change. And I want to say psychological and spiritual change.
Yes.
Has been in the history of the planet. And so bringing forward the value of compassion at this moment is, if you will, the number one priority. There are no other priorities that are more important than bringing this value forth culturally and individually. So this next 10 years, we are in for a lot of sea change. A lot of that is going to be difficult for people. So a quality of resiliency is going to be necessary. But a lot of it's going to be very exciting because new things are going to emerge, which we never imagined. And the possibilities of transforming our communities, as well as our individual selves, into more compassionate beings is the great privilege of this moment.
You know, I feel it. And Dennis and Dana, I mean, when we've talked before, it seems like that's such a common theme. And yet, on an individual basis, it's just there's such polarization.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, I can say, okay, well, you know, you shine a light on the darkness and, you know, and this is, and yeah, we're doing it. But I tell you, for me, there's times when it's kind of discouraging.
It is painful because we see the polarization. And, you know, oftentimes Dana and I talk about the term enantiodroma.
What is that term?
Enantiodroma. And it, basically what it means is the pendulum swings. And when the pendulum swings thus far, it comes back. And what we are seeing at this moment is the pendulum coming back. And I think with that will be a sea change of awareness as we begin to open up to the realization that the old ways, the reptilian ways, are not working anymore. And that we have a vast opportunity to really open ourselves up to a new way of being on the planet.
Mm.
So I did something recently. There was a fellow named Dr. James Gordon who was in Houston after the hurricane. And he's been to the south side of Chicago. He's been to Palestine. He's done a lot of work with the Center for Mind-Body Medicine. And in that work, he did something which was very revealing to me. It was called a genogram. Have you ever heard of this, Clay? Or
no.
No, I have not.
So the genogram allows you to go back 3 or 4 generations and to look at your lineage, look at your family tree, and to recognize the level of trauma associated with each of those. So I went back and I did that work, and I saw that in my father's generation, my grandfather, my great-grandfather, there was betrayal, there was a lack of compassion, there was severe trauma. Every generation for me, except this generation, because I avoided it, I got a good number in the draft, has been to war. So the level of trauma that we've experienced culturally has been extreme. So this is a time of healing. This is a time of regeneration, of transformation. And it's for each of us to really take seriously our responsibility day by day to do this kind of work. Dana's been doing it and doing wonderful work around the Tao Te Ching and how the Tao Te Ching gives us a platform for that kind of transformation as well. But however we find our path, that quality of healing, and I'm not just talking about the healing for my own personal story. I'm talking about the healing, and that's why the genogram is important, is to see that level of trauma, to see that level of difficulty in the previous generations and know that I'm doing something not just for me, but for what has come before.
You know, I have heard about that, and what comes up in mind is something about 7 generations, that it takes 7 generations really to affect change. And if I go back 7 generations, I mean, that's way back. But the seeds for change were back then.
I want to toss this out on the table, because I've been thinking about the difference between, okay, I have a physical gender, but I also have a personality inside of my body, and that personality. And so while my physicality can be evolving, and we can evolve as we evolve from hominid into Homo sapien, and if our consciousness were evolving, how would we know it? If we were in a place of where the evolution was happening, it was occurring, what would be the indicators of it happening? And this is a classic leading question. I'm seeing indicators. I'd like to know if the three of you are seeing indicators that this could be happening, that there is an actual, that we're evolving into our next level of species that is being led by the consciousness that is happening around us.
Dana, do you want to respond to that?
Well, yes. I thank you. And good morning to all of you.
Hey. Good morning, Dana.
Good morning, Dana.
I think we have a transformation of a worldview. And as we form a worldview, we transform ourselves. Our transformation begins locally, but it spreads out globally through the kinds of communities that we find ourselves serving, being a participant in. And even though there are conflicts in the community and throughout the culture, those conflicts don't seem to resonate as long as we come from a place of oneness, harmony, doing goodness in the world, finding opportunities where they happen in a moment by moment basis. And that can be as simple as being gracious at a stop sign or in a line at a supermarket, or as expansive as the kinds of projects that we find ourselves being called to do. The consistency that we bring to this says something about our worldview, because not everybody is going to agree with the worldview that we have. And it doesn't necessarily make conflicting worldviews irrelevant, but the ground of being has room for all of them. And to the degree that we inhabit a worldview that is sustainable to ourselves, our community, and the cosmos, it nurtures us. And we nurture other people, and our worldview becomes a part of the fabric of our being that we can share with everyone.
You know, I so appreciate what you're saying. I've just spent the last 3 days having a marvelous time with my brother. First time I've seen him in a year, and it's hybrid bass fishing time. And we've been slaying bass the past few days. Now, Thomas is a very conservative person. He's a small business owner. He's had a business since 1984. He's raised his family. He's paid for his home. He is a quintessential small business owner, and he's hanging on by his nails right now. And he's in survival mode, and he's in fear, and for good reason. How can we have a higher level of consciousness and do what we're talking about when I look at my brother and we've had such rich conversations because we have a respect for one another and the recognition that I'm more liberal, he's more conservative, that we can have a dialogue. But I think that's kind of the unique case. You know, what do we do?
Is it though? Is it unique, or is it you taking that extra time to connect with him at that level, that namaste level, where mm-hmm. you are all one? And what is this opportunity for us to do this one person at a time? And I love the way that you were bringing that up, Dana, where we were talking about the stop sign, is that if anything matters, it all matters. Then that stop sign is helping, the graciousness of the stop sign is adding to a level, lifting the level of consciousness in the entire realm. This the race, we're moving it upward. We've never been connected in this way the way we are now. So if that is happening, then how can we leverage that?
Yeah, and I think it's just the way you are, Clay, and who you are, and your willingness and ability to sort of put that bridge out between you and your brother. And
thank you.
I think that a lot of individuals, whether they're liberal or conservative, still are living in that kind of fear worldview. And I think what it takes is sort of the next step, which is to see that if we want to affect the seventh generation, then we need to be courageous, we need to be wise, and we need to be compassionate as we move forward. And that's exactly who you are, Clay, and you as well, Dennis, and I know Dana's for so many years. And I know.
You know, here's what just came to mind, and maybe it's a blinding bliss of the obvious, but when Thomas and I sat and spoke the other evening, it wasn't about solving a problem. It wasn't about him trying to convince me or me trying to convince him. It was a dialogue, and it was for no other purpose but to seek to understand and to listen, because I so much want to understand, because every day I've thought about him. I love him. Every day I've thought, my God, all this happening, and he's got this small business, and he's
works himself to a bone. How can he make it? And that's a serious question. And we've talked about that. And he does have a different political view than me. And I respect it. Part of it I still don't quite understand, but I respect where he's coming from. And I think that that's mutual.
And I think, you know, compassion and wisdom are bipartisan issues. I think that anybody you talk to, and so for me, you know, when Rilke says that really the important thing is the question and the quality of willingness to open our hearts to the other point of view. So the rules of engagement with dialogue are really quite simple, which is just a deep respect for each and every personality we meet. And I think there's a burden on the liberal side, which is to carry that quality of respect, because I've seen a lot of people in Black Lives Matter and various movements that have emerged during this period who are just as fearful as our conservative evangelical brothers.
Amen to that. Yeah. I have had to so much face both my privilege and also my own fears and all the opportunities that I have to be part of the solution rather than sitting on the side and be in my victim mode. It is my default place to go into that victim mode. And so if I can stand up and say, I can be in this compassionate mode, what does that mean? How am I able to show up for each and every person?
Realizing that each and every person has intrinsic dignity. There's an inner nobility in spite of what they might say, in spite of the frowns, in spite of it all.
Absolutely.
Nobility associated with each and every personality. So as Thomas Merton says, how could we help but not fall down and worship each other?
Dana, you were about to jump.
Dana.
Well, I was going to follow up on a choice of words that Dennis used, which was victim. And I think in my own set of circumstances, as I think of being victimized, or I think of falling into even thinking about what victim means, there is fear in being a victim. You need fear to feed being a victim. You need an other, that somehow or another there's somebody victimizing you. Mm-hmm. And my sense is that I have such a deep trust that I don't enable the path of becoming a victim to take root in my psyche. And
wonderful.
What I see is that there are practices that we can develop that develop skill. And one of those is showing interest in others. And that interest has to do with how did you get to where you are? And I don't know why we all seem to have a brother who is like hard to deal with sometimes, but you know, whether it's.
Or I'm the hard to deal with one, yeah. Or I am the brother who is hard to deal with.
I don't know. I think that I've made myself into a lovable human being, but there are those who would take exception. They say, you know, and I'm struck by how there's timing in these. And I don't know why this Tao Te Ching project has become so timely. But every time I seem to have a conversation with somebody about it, I'm working on the current verse of something that relates to that. And right now I'm dealing with verse 61, which has to do with like the transference of power when a large country that is well received is living in the lowlands. Everybody loves it. Humility is everywhere, and it's going to conquer the little country. The way it does it is by yielding, and when it yields, it gives power to the little country. And it's like the yin always has a way of coming forth because it can't outmatch through power. So it does it through love. And the yin loves the yang. And so it is a way to right the imbalances by participating along a different power corridor. Mm-hmm. And in doing that, what it happens is that the small overcomes the large. And so when the small submits to the large, it makes the large more powerful. So it comes full circle. And these are the words that I'm dealing with in this current verse. And this project started with just trusting an intuitive path of hearing Jonathan's voice. And you had both me and Jonathan on.
I did.
A week or so ago.
What a wonderful person he is.
It's magical to submit. There are people who go shopping in the supermarket with lists. So they go, and what they do is they wander down the aisles and they get everything that's on their list. And there are other people who go in there with a sort of a sense of what they want to have, and they may or may not find everything, but what they come home with is what they prepare. And neither one's right. I mean, they both work. I just find that in solving the day-to-day issues, to have compassion upon ourselves, to understand what our own complex makeup is, mm-hmm. you know, and to me, that's the little and the large inside each one of us. That's my little dog who has the largest voice in the room. And at the beginning of COVID, we got this darling little, it's called a Woodle, which is a Wheaton Terrier poodle. And, you know, thinking about the pandemic and following the thread of, you know, a dog conversation, you know, you can't even get a dog in the pandemic. Everybody has gotten dogs. The breeders are totally out. The shelters are totally out. And I think that this pandemic has really taught us who we are, what we really need for, you know, companionship, and how something as precious as companionship has really come full force in Zoom. You know?
Yeah, it really has. It's brought us together today.
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly.
And to try and do that face to face, it never happened. So it's been a blessing. Guard, you were about to say something.
Yeah. You know, a friend of mine who's a neuroscientist up at Stanford, Jamil Zaki, has written a book called The War for Kindness.
Hmm.
And the real pandemic is the pandemic of loneliness. And Dana just alluded to that in talking about dogs. And so, you know, the question for me, and a couple of pieces here, what are the practices by which we can bring about this quality of transformation? And one of my teachers, I think I've alluded to before, Thomas Berry, says there's really only three dimensions to our life. There's a vertical dimension, right, where we create more depth. And so what are the practices? What are the meditative, what are the prayer practices that allow us to create more depth in our own personal life? And are we attending to those on a day-by-day basis? So that's our personal responsibility, is to create that depth so that there's a larger capacity to allow that quality of love to move through us to others, as you are doing with your brother, Clay, in dialogue. And then there's the horizontal practice. You know, the horizontal has to do with the social dimension of our lives. And how are we engaging those social dimensions within our families, within our communities, even politically within our nation? How are we engaged? And what are the practices that we're literally doing? I've been blessed since last March to be doing something called Delivering with Dignity, where I deliver meals to at-risk families. And I'm the one who's been blessed. This, for me, is a spiritual practice. So what is the quality of social service on that horizontal? What is the practice that we're engaged in that dimension? So bringing the vertical and the horizontal together creates what we call the longitudinal, which is Clay's personal journey, which is Dennis's personal journey, which is Dana's personal journey, which no other person can duplicate, which only you can discover. So how are you mining the vertical and the horizontal in such a way as to discover, what am I called to? What am I being asked to do? As Dana said earlier, in this moment, what am I being asked to do? I remember being in the back pew of the church many years ago, probably 15 years ago, when there was a lady in the back. She was with a young boy, her son, and he was very young, maybe 4 years old, 5 years old, and we'd never seen her before. And I went up and I asked her, you know, who are you? And welcome. We're so glad to see you here. And she said, well, when I was growing up, this was my town. I love this town of Boulder City. And I've just come from Fresno. I have enough motel money till Tuesday. And then I don't know what. So I said, well, I've got an answer to that. I've got a mother-in-law unit and you're moving into that and you'll save that money and let's figure out how to get you a job. And so again, in every moment, there's a calling. And if we do the vertical practices and we do the horizontal practices and we find a way in which to move that energy, we will discover what we're being called to. Thomas Keating said that we will never really be a beneficial influence unless we have serious disciplines, practices in which we're engaging in those dimensions of our life. And Albert Schweitzer said, I've never known anybody to be happy who doesn't understand selfless service.
That's beautiful.
So what are those practices on those dimensions? That to me is how we move it forward. And I see, answering your other question, Clay, I see through pro-social spirituality, I see through compassionate, the Charter for Compassion, I see through the United Religions Initiative, I see all the signs of the sprouts starting to emerge culturally around the planet, which we probably won't see in our lifetime, but which are emerging, and I think will inure to the benefit of the seventh generation.
You know, we may surprise ourselves with the speed of change that's happening.
Yes.
You know, what may have taken 500 years is going to take much less, possibly. But that brings up a question for me is, and it's a generalization, you know, and I think Socrates said, what are we going to do with the younger generation? You know, what I'm hearing is, and again, this is through my brother. He said, so many of the young folks that come to work for me are entitled. They have this entitlement mentality. They've got no loyalty to the business. They, you know, it doesn't matter to them if they're let go here. They just get another job there. They don't care about the resume. And again, this is a generalization, but it brings up the question in my mind. Yeah, we're all older gentlemen, and we can talk about this. What about the young folks?
May I take a shot at it?
Please. Yes. You're the producer. You can do whatever.
Here is, well, thank you. I shall claim my right. I'm a Maxine. I'm
going to
claim my time. What I have learned about the younger generation and the millennials and the people that are there is that this attitude of it's an interpretation of entitlement, but that's not what I think it is. What I think it is that what they're asking is, show me how I'm going to make a difference from day one. Connect me to purpose. Show me that I matter. Show me that what I do matters, and take that extra step to show me how it works within the system, and I will give you more than you ever could possibly have imagined, as long as you connect me to purpose. In the past, when I was growing up over at 73, as I was coming up to, it was always, well, don't worry. Once you get into management, then you can be dealing with purpose. Other than that, just do your job. And that was the mindset that we were growing up in. But the kids, because they have been exposed to, they're saying, I don't want to be CEO on day one, but I want to know how I'm going to make a damn difference. And if we can connect them to that, suddenly the entitlement dissipates and they are willing to contribute and they're willing to be part of the process.
Wow. Wow. Well, yeah, well said.
I also think there's something else going on, that in that generation, that they didn't want to follow the same path that they saw being laid out ahead of them by the parents and the culture.
Amen.
And by not having a realistic possibility to either own the home or fulfill themselves. By then, the corporate structure had devolved to such a point there wasn't any realistic way of participating in a long-range game plan. They decided, you know, to cut their losses and start out living a life that they themselves had control over. And I think many of us in the 60s started down that path at considerable risk in terms of, you know, launching out onto your own and doing things that put you on a career path that didn't resonate with the culture in which it was situated. And that was part of a problem. It seems that that hasn't been an unworkable model. And I think that's what these young people are now adapting to, is you can't afford a home today in many of the communities. You can't work yourself through college. And the idea of paying $50,000 to $70,000 to $100,000 a year and doing it on your own, it's just not feasible. So I think they've taken a very prudent path of finding a path of meaning, a path of making a contribution, of doing whatever they want, but in some way getting through this period of their lives to try to find out who they are and what their lives are about. And they haven't been looking to the parents or the community or the culture for the answers.
Yeah, and I would say the Pew Research bears that out, Dana, that, you know, most young people today are wanting to be spiritual, but they don't want to be religious.
Mm-hmm.
They want purpose, but they don't want politics.
Thank you.
They want meaning, but they don't want business as usual. So I think part of the mea culpa, part of the confession is good for the soul line, is the recognition that our institutions in many regards are bankrupt, and that religiously, commercially, politically, we are in a state of bankruptcy right now. And yeah. So as I say, as a former CPA, let's not go chapter 7 where we totally implode. Let's go chapter 11 where we reorganize.
Love it.
What does reorganization mm-hmm. mean in this moment?
Oh.
Taking a look at the values that are undergirding our institutions. And, you know, I know the two federal senators from the state of Nevada, they're dear friends. And I say, can you help me understand why you just can't have what you have, Clay, with your brother, a dialogue, a meaningful dialogue in which you engage on the really serious questions and not talk about Dr. Seuss or some of these things, but talk about the really meaty stuff.
Sure.
And they tell me because they're of the fear, because of the constituencies, because of, bless his soul, what Donald Trump has done to really create a culture, a toxic culture within at least one of the political parties.
Right.
How do we diffuse that? That really is the big question of the moment.
Let's do that. Let's take on that big question, because that big question, not that we are at all going to solve it, but we can, that's a wonderful question to explore.
Mm-hmm. And I think it goes back to, you know, we have a free medical clinic in Las Vegas, and the acronym of our vision, of our values, is TRUST, which mm-hmm. is teamwork, respect for every person that we involve ourselves with, the quality of unity of purpose, quality of service with excellence, and transparency or authenticity. goes back to the heart and soul of every institution and culture, which is trust.
Thank you. And when you talk to your senators and you say, what small thing would you be willing to do to increase the level? If we talk about trust, I look at it as a continuum from 0 to 1. We're somewhere along this continuum. It isn't just a binary state. But what would we be willing to do that would move the needle a tiny bit toward greater at-one-ment, that unity, that one, that greater trust, and move that trust that could happen? Because however that is going to occur, it must be something that we're all in. I love, if there were trust, if they started off every Senate and every House of Representatives meeting with that statement, we are here for trust, for those five principles. That's what we're going to use. I can't see any objection to it, and I can see every positive to doing that.
Well, Dennis, it's interesting because I actually spoke to one of our congresswomen, Susie Lee, and I said, Susie, I would like to propose a piece of legislation that at the beginning of every congressional session, every senator, every congressperson signs a pledge to trust, to open their hearts and minds to a more meaningful dialogue with the other side, no matter who the other side is. But every session, every single one of them, and if they don't sign it, then there you have a metric, Clay. There you have a metric.
That feels so good. And this is the kind of conversation, because if we can get to there, if we can get to the place where we can say, this is important. These are our principles before personalities, and making sure that we adhere to these principles.
I just envision where, you know, they're in Congress, the question being asked, where is the compassion in this? Where's the compassion in this? And that's a hard question, I think, today to answer, when it should be the easiest question to answer.
But compassion isn't always saying yes.
Uh-uh. Compassion's tough. Yeah. I mean, Garg, you mentioned that last time.
It's the toughest. If the toughest value there is, if people truly understood it.
Yeah.
Because it requires you to keep yourself vulnerable, to keep your heart open, and people are afraid of doing that because they've been traumatized.
Of course.
It requires you to keep your mind open to new possibilities and new imaginative ways, but people are afraid to do it. So how do we open that up? So I would actually, Clay, I challenge you to give me that piece of legislation. I will give it to our congressional delegation. There's only one that won't listen, but I won't tell you which party. but the others will listen. And they are the kind of people, we have the kind of relationship, they'll do something about this. And I think it's time. I think that seventh generation deserves a politic, a business culture, Wall Street, where every person is required to sign a basic code of trust, of ethics.
Exactly. Yeah. And we're seeing this. This is, I've been talking with some of the younger people who have a very dark view of capitalism. And I'm a capitalist. I believe in the capitalistic system. I just believe that the capitalistic system can have more than just a red and black bottom line, that it can have a rainbow of bottom lines, that there's many, that there is a corporate contract, a responsibility that we can have. There are many ways that we can say that the good of the company is what our contribution is and what we can be in part of it. There's so many opportunities that we can explore within capitalism of what I believe is the market. In addition, that we can have the market put pressure on the political system to have exactly what you're talking about, because I'm seeing these kinds of values in the companies that I consult with and in the corporations. I'm seeing these values being discussed, being one major company that I'm working with is sitting there going, I sit there, we have all these diversity principles, and yet constantly we're not seeing the diversity getting into the senior management. And we are working. It's hard work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Boy, you talk about senior management, and I just reflect back on my corporate days, and it seemed the higher up people went in the organization, the more rope tricks that they're doing, you know, for their, you know, their investors. And we have such a short timeline of performance, you know, quarterly performance.
That boy, is that awful. Who can do in 3 months, who can possibly say in 3 months that there is, it's an extraordinary time. Dana, how are you, your connection with corporate, because you've been around in the corporate world. You spent many years in entertainment and through mm-hmm. The role of entertainment and the role of literature and the role of this in changing the consciousness of people and bringing compassion up is such a powerful opportunity in this connected world.
I'm struck by the word choices that we're all making. And one of the characteristics that I have always felt as critical to maintaining autonomy and survival and growth is fluidity. And it has to do with water. And the irony is that when I was a child and I started off my career as a human being, I realized that, you know, I didn't have the advantage of size. And so I became a swimmer. And the loss of water in anything produces structural cracks. And what happens is that erosion produces a sense or an anxiety about survival. And often companies, rather than change, will try to knuckle down and market the few things that they have and hold on to the enterprise.
How human of us.
And I think that, you know, the problems that we have are not teaching nature as a model for our human organization system. And learning from how to adapt and change and morph ourselves into the kinds of human beings that will make a contributing, healing, creative part of the culture and the cosmos. What it seems to me is that we've lost our real trust in the imagination. And I think that if there's an organizing principle to existence, it has to do with the ability to invent itself anew. And new species are constantly being born, new forms of life. When you talked about the accelerated patterns that have moved us into our current situation, let's think about those as the, I don't want to necessarily think about them as problems, but they are the circumstances that have initiated the reality that we are all currently experiencing. Those accelerated patterns are also going to lead to accelerated solutions, because we're used to dealing now with a connected world where the opportunities to make reality available to us happen on a real moment-by-moment basis. So now means something. I mean, there was kind of an abstract 50 years ago. I mean, we talked about Be Here Now, and when Ram Dass wrote his wonderful book, Be Here Now was sort of something where it was the antithesis of living a life according to organization and a plan. The Peter Drucker School of Management taught you that, you know, you need to know where you're going in order to get to where you think you want to be. Well, Alice in Wonderland teaches us that if you don't know where you're going, any path will get you there. And I think that if we really want to find ourselves, we have to have as many options as available as possible. As soon as we select one, it eliminates all the other possible options. And this is really wisdom that I think that the younger generation has seized upon. You know, my one son has decided about a year and a half ago to uproot himself and move to Berlin to test the waters professionally. 2 weeks ago, he landed a prime job in Berlin, and he's the principal photographer for a company called Carhartt or something like that. It's a youth clothing manufacturer, it's a worldwide company. So now he has the opportunity to invent a life in a language in which that he doesn't speak the language in a country. They'll pay for his German instruction, but they all speak English anyway. I think there are so many options available to us if we would only open our eyes and look. Zoom is easily one. You know, the ability to connect with a community of people and to initiate discussions, to listen to one another, they've never been broader. So the growth potential of what we're encountering today is unbelievable. And so I think the solutions are going to come at the same rate or faster than the problems arise.
Yeah, I think we're in an interesting moment. You know, you alluded to Peter Drucker. Drucker also said culture eats strategy for lunch. And I'm involved with a company where when we have board meetings, we talk about culture at the board meetings. We don't look at P&Ls. We don't look at balance sheets. We don't talk about five-year plans. We don't actually even hire, bless their souls, MBAs, and I'm one. But what we do is we talk about how do we create a winning solution whereby our employees, our customers, our vendors, our community, our owners, everybody is a winner. And we have really established a culture in which if any one of those is losing, then we're all losing. How do we begin to shift our conversations away from what you've talked about, Dennis and Clay, that short-term quarterly P&L strategy, earnings per share report, to a conversation about culture? And what Darwin observed and what I would suggest pro-social spirituality is doing a great job in this is to really acknowledge that compassion is the leading edge of a winning culture. And when we begin to embed that into the culture of our organizations and institutions, then that bankruptcy I talked about earlier becomes a store of wealth. And wealth isn't being rich. Wealth is being happy. And how do we create that for everybody?
Oh, what a wonderful opportunity. I'm going to put a pin in it right there. For me, I'm going to, and I encourage everyone to stay along for the after party because these three gentlemen are going to go. And I am going to leave the conversation uplifted, elevated, and to have the opportunity to graciously be with you, Dana White, with you, Garth Jamieson, and my dear, dear Clay Boykin. Thank you, everyone, and we will see you next time on In Search of the New Compassionate Male.
Poof.
He does that, doesn't he?
The wizard's curtain has closed.
You know,
associate you have there, Clay.
Oh, he's just wonderful. I just jotted down three things: chaos, compassion, and change, and the interplay between those. Who was it? Tom Peters. You remember him? Back in 88, I think he came out with his book, Thriving on Chaos. And I always said, because I said, well, I was studying Peter Drucker and Tom Peters and what I learned in the Marine Corps and what Motorola was telling us. And, you know, what's my leadership style? But I remember Tom Peters in the preface said that the winners of tomorrow are not the ones who view chaos as a problem to be got around, but as a source of market advantage. And we can translate that beyond just business. And it goes back, I think, you know, guard to the very beginning of our conversation here. This is a tremendous opportunity for change. You know, I mean, even astrologically, you know, it's the planet alignments even are speaking about it. So.
We had a fellow, D-Hawk, who started the Visa Corporation. And he wrote a book called Chaotic. And it's about how you bring order and chaos together. And that is exactly what he experienced as he allowed the Visa Corporation to emerge, because it was so many different institutions. How do you bring them all together? And it goes back to Dana's point about imagination. Could we imagine a worldwide platform that would work for everybody on the planet, that would allow them to engage in commercial enterprise in a way that was really egalitarian? D-Hawk walked away as, unlike so many of our new entrepreneurs, not as a billionaire, but as a very wealthy individual, because he had created this organization. Mm-hmm. So we started something called the United Religions Initiative through that same idea, working with appreciative inquiry and the realization that when we build on assets and not focus on liabilities and threats, then we have an opportunity for imagination to thrive. And now the United Religions Initiative, as you know, Clay, is the largest interfaith organization on the planet, with over 1,000 every continent, over 1,000 cooperation circles. And that's the hope of the future, is small groups of individuals who are cooperating, who are having the kind of dialogue that you talked about. And it's not going to come from Washington, D.C., or Boston, or any of our capitals. It's going to come from the grassroots up.
Boy, I so agree with that.
I like the pragmatism, Clay, that you bring into In Search of the Compassionate Male. I think it is blissfully one of the things that is lacking from the Myth Salon, is that we often don't tie it into a kind of a hybrid approach to the real world. So it remains a sort of a recreational spiritual journey, which isn't bad. I mean, we're getting great hits and people like it, and it's wonderful. The thing about us is that we are hybrid individuals by nature. And so we have creative and spiritual and business and family and athletic and all these kind of energies playing with our worldview and our perspective. And in the same way that we need to have the conversation among those attributes inside ourselves, we need to form those kinds of relationships outside of ourselves. And I was always struck by the narrowness of friendships that adult males typically had. So engineers hung out with engineers, and athletes hung out with other athletes, and musicians hung out with other musicians. And it never seemed to me to be a good healthy mix for anything beyond redundancy. And what I find is that with somebody, for example, like Guard, it always I was always honored that he reached out to me after our doctoral work together. And out of all of the people in the class that he could have like seized upon, he called me. And it was just been a wonderful, productive interchange, pragmatic. I mean, I can't say enough about how it's grown, but it grew out of trust. It grew out of inquiry. It grew out of need, grew out of opportunity. But these are things that normally have been characterized as between the lines of particular disciplines. So you had departments that were stratified in corporations where the research and development people didn't talk to the marketing people, or the financial department didn't talk about, you know, the account executives. I mean, they just were like different people.
Gosh, I so remember that because, again, back in the 80s, we got into this great debate, you know, do we organize, you know, with organization charts by product line, or do we organize by market, you know, and go more task oriented? And, you know, with this and this and this, and we actually changed the organizations back and forth every couple of years. And the great debate. And you know, so are we line driven or are we project driven? And it was either or. I said, wait a second, guys. Wait a second. We're smart enough that it's yes and. You can have a structural, you know, you can have the organization chart, build them as many as you want. But when it goes to do the work, it's just like what you said, Dana. It's a hybrid. It's a mix. Bring the diversity together. That's where the work gets done. Then you can go home at night and roost, you know, on the organization chart. But it was such a fundamental, and, you know, we were all questioning it, you know, either or. No, it's yes and.
Yeah, I have a friend who trained with Robin Williams, and that's my mantra for these days is yes and. You know, if ever I see that but or however creep into my language, I have to just be mindful and I have to say, okay, something's going on here and it's about me, not about you, and I need to deal with it because yes and is the only way to go forward.
It's always a practice because I catch myself as well.
Exactly. A friend of mine said, but is an eraser word. You just erased everything that went before.
Yeah. I want to ask a question. Guard, you leveled a challenge to me.
I did. And I said, Clay, as somebody who has interviewed so many people and done such great work around compassion, if you were to write a statement, which as a congressional leader, if they all signed it, you would be a very happy person. What would that statement say? Mm-hmm. Could you articulate that? Because I will tell you, I will take it to my congressional delegation and I will say, you know, I really think this is important right now. A lot of us think this is important. But I would love to have you be the drafter of that, especially coming from Texas. Which is
a challenge.
Well, thank you. I accept that challenge, and what a beautiful opportunity. And, you know, I'm not going to try and put words to it right now. I can feel it, and it is not a long document. It is a short document. It's the Mark Twain way. If I had more time, this would have been a shorter letter.
If any one of those people didn't sign that,
yeah,
that would say a lot about them.
My goodness, yeah. Wow. I tell you what, we hit so many topics today. Going another level deeper.
So I'm curious, Clay, if I might go back and ask you a question.
Sure.
You've been doing these podcasts now for quite some time. Mm-hmm. So where are you at right now? What are you seeing? I heard a little bit earlier that there's a little bit of despair over some of the things you're seeing, but what are you seeing that makes you hopeful and encourages you as we move forward here?
You know, on a macro scale, I see it and I feel it. And this is one thing that getting to know you and getting to know Dana and getting into Myth Salon and through all that, meeting Richard Tarnas and so forth, I have a tendency to go back and, you know, look at ancient history. And along the way, I learned about, you know, Copernicus. And he stood up one day and said, "Hey, guys, we got this wrong. You know, it's the Earth rotates around the sun, not the other way around." And what a fundamental change that was at that point, 500 years ago. And it set off the separation between spirituality and science. You know, they kind of diverged from that, the patriarchal system, although it existed before, it was accentuated, the myth of progress, all of those things. And I believe that we're at that juncture right now, and it supports what you were saying, Gard, that this is it. This is the time. And I see it, I feel it. We're kind of in the liminal space, mm-hmm. which people say, "Oh, nothing's happening." Well, let me tell you, in the liminal space, everything's happening. This is a place to be alive. And a friend of mine said, "You know, an airplane, you know, how does it fly? Well, the fast air below the wing and the slower air above the wing, you get lift." Yes, but it's what happens on the leading edge of that wing. All the chaos. I mean, that wind is just kicking around all over. It's total chaos. Without that, that plane wouldn't fly. And so I get that. And then I go back into the trenches and you made the point, you know, this is a one-on-one, this is a dialogue. And I felt, and I was reminded of the feeling that I had when Thomas, my brother, and I were talking the other night. Mm-hmm. It wasn't solving problems. And I had this deep sense of feeling, so sense of compassion, sense of love, and understanding and not understanding, but understanding, you know, and being okay with that. And we grew together very subtly. We grew closer together, and we were both changed either on the macro level or on the micro level. And it was through dialogue.
Beautiful.
So
beautiful.
There's also wisdom in not needing to convince everybody to your point of view. And for somebody who is deeply entrenched in a contrasting worldview, I think a compassionate point of view is to let them be and come to an enlightened point of view, if that's what yours is and you believe in it, on their own. You know, live by example, you know.
You're exactly right. I mean, you know, go back to the Kuzis and Posner leadership challenge. You know, create an inspired vision, model the way, mm-hmm. challenge the process, encourage the heart, mm-hmm. you know, those principles. And it's what you said, make the example. Model the way. How do you show up? How do I show up? That's number one. Because people see you, Gard, they see each one of us and how we show up in the day. What are we doing? And that speaks volumes over what I'm saying.
Rufus Jones, who won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1948 for his work during World War I, and he didn't accept it. He accepted it for the whole Quaker community. He didn't accept it for himself. He said, "I pin my hopes on small groups of transforming trust."
Mm-hmm. I like that.
It's not the halls of Congress. It's not Wall Street. It's small groups like this that are gathering, having these conversations, mm-hmm. and having them on an ongoing basis, not just a one-on, but an ongoing conversation where we can really dive deeper and more horizontally. And as we do that, discover our longitude for each of us. So I really thank you, Clay, for sponsoring these programs and for pushing this leading edge of the wing with all of the chaos that ensues. And You know, I think I speak for Dana. Anything that we can do to facilitate your journey, you know, we're brothers, and we're here to help you. So thank you.
I feel that, and I so am so grateful for it. I really do. Was there anything else that we had hadn't hit? I'm going to go back and I'm going to study this one.
I'm always grateful for a moment when Guard's mobility pattern exceeds mine. I tend, you know, to stay in a small space and get still. I try anyway. And the amount of quality being that Guard has in his world and his ability to influence by example, I would say. I mean, people see him and they know where he's coming from. He resonates authenticity. And I think that as a model for me and everyone else, it is such a good model to get one through the next moment at the stop sign or in the supermarket or wherever we happen to be, to find a moment where, you know, compassion serves.
Yeah.
Back at you, Dana. And Dana alluded to something which I'll close with here, which is we too often neglect the natural beauty and the patterns and the laws which nature sets out. And Emerson said it best. He said, natural beauty is God's handwriting. And if it's God's handwriting, then we have the text. We know how we are to proceed.
Mm-hmm.
And what we observe in nature, as I'm sure Tarnas and others have shared, is that there's a way in which community forms for the benefit of all. And that's how species survive. That's how species move forward. So the issue is, how can each of us become a beneficial influence for the benefit of all? I think that's the challenge. So I look forward to your statement, Clay. It's going to go to our entire congressional delegation, except one, maybe. I love him, but I don't think he'll take it. But thank you for this opportunity. And again, thank you for the work that you're doing. Thank you for your engagement with the Charter for Compassion. There's so many different groups that really are trying to bring this world to a better place.
Thank you, Guard. Thank you for your time. You're a busy person, and I'm grateful for that. And Dana, same. Thanks for bringing us together.
Wonderful to see both of you this morning. Thank you very much.
Y'all have a great day.
Well,
God bless you.
God bless you.